Thank you, Don Fernando. Thank you very much. I would like to hear the dean of the ICADE faculty, which is co-organizing this event with the Rafael del Pino Foundation, so that he can also welcome us as Don Fernando Bedoya.
Welcome and thank you very much. Thank you very much to Fundación Rafael del Pino, and also thank you very much to Perez Llorca, and of course, for our panelists, Professor Sonia Raja, Professor House, and Professor Fernández Armesto. For us, for University of Comillas, for ICADE, today is a very, very important day. The thing is, we are going to accomplish a little bit more our mission as a new university. And I want to explain you why I say thank you and why it's so important. Our university, as you know, is a very special one. It has some values in the core, in the real DNA of our faculty. And these values in Latin are utilitas, humanitas, and justitia. Now, utilitas, which means that all what we do have to be useful, always useful. And this is something that is got to the authentic inner of all the alumni of Comillas. Here we have two of them, like Professor Fernández Armesto and Manuel Jiménez Racero, alumni of ICADE, because wherever we are, we try to serve. We try to be useful. And I know that this act of today is going to be useful. So we are fulfilling the utilitas value. We are also fulfilling the humanitas value. The humanitas value means that the person is the center of everything for us. It's the center of law, it's the center of the economy, and it's the center of the business. And at the end, I know that at the end of all this, we are trying to serve and to solve problems of persons. And justitia, which means justice. Of course, arbitration has a lot to do with justice. I would say that justice, in the way we think, is that we have to be always, we always have to try to have a critical approach to reality. This world that we live have a lot of unfairness, and we have to fight. We have to propose alternative solutions. We have to be there where there are problems and try to solve them. So I think that this day is going also going to serve to justitia. So that's what I'm so thank you. Because we are going to be useful, we are going to serve persons, and we are going to serve fairness, to serve justice. So thank you very much. I know that at the end of the morning, we are going to be richer in an intellectual way. I mean, that we're going to have a lot of food for thought. We're not going to get any money, I think, at the end of this day. So thank you very much to Fundación Rafael del Pino, Perez Llorca, all the co-organizers, and of course, thank you very much for the panelists. And thank you very much, all of you, that you are going to be a very important part of the debate. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Decano. We shouldn't be wasting our and your time, but let me give a few acknowledgments and a few remarks on how this is going to work. First, I have to apologize, Mr. Vicente Montes, the General Director of the Fundación Rafael del Pino. He was very much looking forward to being with us, but he has had an emergency, which is, because I know it, a real emergency that has prevented him from being with us today. But he wanted to share how proud the Rafael del Pino is for hosting this seminar today and the Madrid Arbitration Day as an ongoing event. I just would like to highlight that the Rafael del Pino Foundation, although it is a institution created for the promotion of the freedom of enterprise, it is above the promotion of the freedom of enterprise in favor of the freedom of thought, and that's why they never hesitated in bringing to their table professors like Professor Sorner, who is very much critical with the system of investment arbitration and the relation between investment and development. Well, I want to thank also Pérez Llorca that has unhesitantly supported the Madrid Arbitration Day over the last 3 years, contributing not only financially but also in terms of the ideas on the development of this new model of an ongoing video blog system that will pick all your contributions and will deposit and offer them in the internet so that all the critics to the investment dispute system can resort to when they have to find arguments in favor of or against having a system of investment protection and a system of adjudication in the investment protection system. I want to thank the Law School of ICADE, my alma mater and where I teach, and very especially the dean, because he has always supported strongly the very existence of this Madrid Arbitration Day. I'm sure that we would never be here without the support of the law school, but very especially the support of Professor Íñigo Navarro. I want to thank Rob House, who was my professor at NYU in investment disputes, because he showed me how important it was the system, but how important it was that the system was fair. He never, when we first talked about coming to Madrid, we knew that the level of interest is increasingly important in Spain towards investment arbitration. And we don't know, we will have to talk, whether the level of information is parallel with the level of interest. I want to thank Professor Sorna, because when I was talking with Gus Van Harten, a Canadian law professor who is very critical with the investment dispute system as well, we agreed that if we had to invite somebody with a critical and studied and deeply thought view on why there should not be a system for investment protection, it was Professor Muthukumara Swani Sornara. And the first time that, but I pronounce it well.
It's good.
And he was pretty much looking forward to coming for the discussion. He has already did a few insightful interventions that have been evaluated through the Twitter critically. And let's see what he has to say today. And last, and obviously not least, I want to thank my professor, Juan Fernández Armesto, who is my humble opinion, the most relevant figure, not only in the domain of arbitration, but also in the domain of promoting the access of young lawyers to the profession, to having their place, to finding their place in their professions. He's very generous being here today, and I appreciate, and we appreciate very much that. And that's all. Let's now move to the organization remarks. We had offered you a seminar. You should be, you ought to be asking yourselves why we are not in a seminar way, in a round table. Well, it's an issue of how important we consider the video blog that has been created and sponsored by Pérez Llorca. The two cameras that we have, one is on the front and the second is in the back, and it would have been impossible to record yourselves and bring you to the web page if we were in a round table. But that means that first, keep in mind that you're going to be recorded, that now you're being streamed in the internet. So if you have, this is a legal remark, and most of us are lawyers. Please, if anyone has any kind of reservation or does not want his or her image to be broadcasted, please let us know, because it is very easy to cut the broadcasting during your intervention. Second, we have the hashtag MadArb, which is open for usage. We will be tweeting the event, because the idea is that not only those that are in this room today, but the rest of the academia, the rest of the community, have the opportunity to share your thoughts. So once we finish with the first part, please introduce yourself, your name, and elaborate your questions. And having said that, let's start the debate. The way we propose that we organize this is that first we give the floor to Professor Sorna, because his views are tremendously, very much critical on the existence of the investment dispute system and the relation between investment and development. He's pretty much critical with the sacralization of private property and the sacralization of contracts. So we will get his critical views on that. And then we will give the floor to Professor Juan Ernesto, because he is a recognized arbitrator, but we do know, because we have heard him in other environments, that he's pretty much critical as well. So we will ask him to evaluate the views of Professor Sorna, and then with both interventions we will switch to Professor House, because he has been writing extensively about the rationale for a system, a judicial, or so-called an adjudication system for investment disputes, and he has been evaluating the different alternatives that we have on the table today. The CETA, the investment court system, probably as well the adjudication in domestic courts. When we are done with that, we will give you the floor so that you can do your interventions, so that you can share your thoughts and also ask your questions to the panelists and to the rest of the audience. So, Professor Sorna, the floor is yours. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Professor Manuel Jimenez-Raceros, for having invited me here, and of course, Dean Navarro, for his kind invitation for me to be present here on the Madrid Arbitration Day. I shouldn't be here because, as you know, I am an inveterate opponent of arbitration, and I am the least likely person to be invited to an arbitration conference. But I am here fortified in the view that the Dean has stated, that we are all for humanitas and justitia, and I believe that arbitration, particularly investment arbitration, serves neither humanitas nor justitia. The arc of universal morality will always turn towards justice, even if it takes a long time. When I started on this topic in 1992, there was very few people with me opposing investment arbitration. But now, when I look around, I would see that there are demonstrations all over Europe, in Asia, in the United States, against investment arbitration. So we see then that the arc of justice is slowly turning towards justice in confronting this rather insidious method of investor-state arbitration. We see that the world is in dire straits now, because we see that there is Brexit, there is the election of Donald Trump in the United States, both of which are not in the interests of humanitas or of justitia. I would say that the events leading to it are illustrated to a large extent in a crucible by the law on investment arbitration, because this is a law that has been created in order to serve the interests of the very few and to the detriment of the very large members of humanity. The justification given is that there would be economic development for everyone, but we cannot see that economic development taking place. You know, you go back in history to the time of Spain's aggression of Latin America. Two great international lawyers, Suarez and Vitoria, the Salamanca school, justified it on the basis that universal brotherhood and the interests of trade would provide justification for the Spanish aggrandizement of the Aztec and the Maya people. Later, we find the same justifications being used by Grotius in order to justify the Dutch expansion into Southeast Asia, the idea of the freedom of the high seas, the idea of freedom of trade. These were notions that were used in order to ensure that justification was provided for the expansion of Dutch power and of British power. The whole of international law was subverted in order to ensure that justification was provided for the expansion of a group of people, not all English, not all Spain, not all Dutch, but a group of people who constituted the major companies like the British East India Company or the Dutch East India Company to profit through the exploitation of other people. Now in the 20th, 21st centuries, we see the same thing happening. We see that international law is being subverted in order to provide a system which is fully in favor of the expansion of multinational corporations going around the world that would be able to exploit the resources of the different countries of the world to their advantage, to replenish their wealth, to ensure that their shareholders would be able to profit as much as possible. One cannot say that this is to the advantage of all people, not all people in Spain or the United States, not all people in Asia or in Africa. It is the employment of private power that is utilized in order to secure international law through the use of low order sources of international law. The low order sources in Article 30, in the article of the International Statute being judicial authority, like arbitration tribunals, and the writings of the so-called highly qualified publicists, meaning people who write in the major universities of the world centered in the Western countries. So what we find is that there is a creation of law that has come about in order to justify the exploitation of the resources of the poorer people of their of the world. This privileges inequality of amongst people. The widening gap between the rich and the poor is observed by many economists like Roderick Stiglitz and others. They speak of the growing gap of inequality, the fact that wealth is centered in the hands of 1% of the people and that the rest are left behind. It is this disgruntled people who resort to techniques that contort notions of justice and humanity today. So why do I sort of target investment arbitration? Investment arbitration, I feel, is a way in which new law is created that privileges the very rich, the multinational companies, their ability to go around the world. And you provide justification for it. The way that Grotius or Vittoria provided justifications in the past, you talk in terms of the rule of law. You talk in terms of the need for an international body of rules of governance. And we would then say that the same techniques are being used today in order to bolster up a law or a body of legal principles that are very similar to the ones that were used in the past. We were told, for example, by the British that they had a standard of civilization to which all countries should aspire to. They justified colonialism on the ground that they had a mission, the white man's burden of bringing the black and the brown people of Asia and Africa to the same standard of civilization. Until then, they should not be given independence. We have a repeat of that same argument in modern times through the notion that everyone must protect certain rules, certain minimum rules. The right to property, the right to contract become sanctified as a result of rules being created that ensure that investment is given absolute protection around the world, even despite the fact that multinational corporations may be acting to the detriment of the people in a country. So we find that multinational corporations have sufficient personality to bring claims against states, but states have no basis on which they could bring actions against multinational corporations, because the fiction is maintained in terms of international law that multinational corporations do not have sufficient personality to be interpleaded in courts of law, in international courts in any event. So what has happened is that there is a profusion of rules that are being created without the consent of states by arbitrators through a series of arbitral awards which are rationalized as constituting a body of precedent. They would deny that there is any precedent in arbitration, but you would see that they do follow each other's awards. The treaties are there, no doubt. Treaties have been there for a long period of time. But when neoliberalism dawns with, I would suggest, in 1990 onwards, with the triumph of the United States and the fall of the Soviet Union, you have a profusion of investment treaties which center upon investment protection as their solitary basis. The aim then is to enhance the protection of the investor on the basis that this is the best way of ensuring that economic development would take place in developing countries. The idea simply is that if you make treaties, then there would be further investment flows that would move into the developing countries of Africa and Asia, which have made these treaties. This is not a provable fact. There's a lot of economic literature that has accumulated, which shows that there is no link at all between the making of treaties and the flows of foreign investment. Investments would flow on sound economic grounds, not because there are treaties, or there are not treaties. There are countries into which investment flows which have no treaties at all, like Brazil, for example. Investments will flow into South Africa despite the fact that the South Africans are bent upon terminating all their treaties. So this is a fiction that has been maintained. And it is on the basis of this fiction, and I would suggest a fraud, that this whole law has been built. The law has been built largely, of course, with on the basis of treaties, but on the basis of these treaties, there is a superstructure which has been created by arbitrators. For example, in the case of jurisdiction, they would say that an investor from Spain could go to Holland, incorporate in Holland, and come back with his investments into Spain and be protected as a Dutch investor, something which no state would have ever thought about. But in Tokyo Tokeles and in other cases, this technique has been accepted. Then there's the idea of a Dutch sandwich, that you could go to Holland, incorporate a company, and use the Dutch treaties. There is the idea that investments would cover government bonds, even if the purchaser had purchased these bonds in other countries. So what is happening here is that the scope of jurisdiction is being expanded quite substantially in order to ensure that as many multinational corporations as possible with disputes could be accommodated within the system of investment arbitration. So when countries like Greece and perhaps Spain as well undergo problems, there is the great threat that that arbitration would be used against whatever measures they take in order to curb the economic crisis that may have arisen or may be impending. To that extent, then, there is this great fear that has been created by this system that a state would not be able to act in order to forestall crisis or to take measures when crises have taken place. So in the case of the protection of human rights, the protection of protection against environmental pollution, the protection of labor rights, indigenous rights. There is a great reluctance on the part of states to move simply because of the existence of these treaties that provide inflexible investment protection, despite the fact that the measures taken are to the benefit of society at large. Substantive rules, the same process has taken place. Now, when I started writing the first edition of my book on the international law on foreign investment in 1992, I had just half a page on fair and equitable treatment. None of us knew what the scope of this particular provision is, because, as you know, as lawyers know, fair and equitable are two terms which can never be interpreted adequately. The meaning that is ascribed to them would differ from person to person. These are very nebulous terms that cannot accommodate any meaning. Come 2000, come the Argentine crisis, we have fixed definitions arising, given to the fair and equitable treatment. And now you have young people, I see here a lot of young people writing PhD thesis on investment arbitration. Good luck to them. I hope that they would produce a lot of tomes on this particular area. Now, there are about six different published theses on legitimate expectations in fair and under fair and equitable treatment. Now, there's this great industry then, which has been spawned by international lawyers and supervisors in different faculties of universities in Europe, promoting thesis on just this single idea: what is a legitimate expectation in investment arbitration? So you have tomes of literature on this, different articles, different books written on this, on a phenomenon that is, to my mind, very short-lived, because you can never explain the theoretical basis on which legitimate expectations can be created. It is derived from English law, where it is not treated as a substantive right. And many of the legal systems of the world would deny the idea that legitimate expectations that arise from assurances given by governments can be substantive, can create substantive rights, because governments are there to break their promises. You know, I mean, that's the function of a government, to break promises whenever circumstances change. And what is this idea about legitimate expectations? It just cannot be. As one writer puts it quite fairly, it is to require such high standards of governance, particularly from developing countries, because most of the countries that are affected would be developing countries. Though I see now that Spain has some 20-odd arbitrations, and legitimate expectations is going to become a feature of such arbitrations, judging by the Farin versus Spain case that has been decided. But you're going to be hit with another 23-odd arbitrations which are going to re-agitate this point relating to the fair and equitable treatment and legitimate expectations under it. Now, we are also told that these are old treaties, that now we have...
We're going to exhaust taking notes, we're going to exhaust the notebooks.
Yeah. I have five more minutes. So now, I was told I could speak for 15 minutes, so I got the time here. Now we are told that there are balanced treaties, and CETA is a balanced treaty. What is a balanced treaty? The balanced treaty protects the regulatory right of a state and provides defenses to liability for state actions to be taken. Now, my problem simply is this: why should a state have to defend itself from taking regulatory action in favor of the public interest? Isn't that the very function of a state? The state exists to protect its public, not the other way around. You protect the investor, and as an exception, you have this regulatory right to act in the public interest, or an exception or a defense to plead when the act is to promote the welfare, the morals, and the health of the people. I mean, it's putting the cart before the horse, right? Because the state is there essentially to protect the public interest. That is the primary function of the state. I don't know whether you were told this, but studying law back in Asia, we were told salus populi, suprema lex, the safety of the people, that's the highest law. What does the investment treaty, the so-called balance treaty, do? It puts this supreme law at the bottom. The supreme law is the protection of the investor. Others come next. That cannot be. That's not sound law. Cicero would be turning in his grave if you tell him that this is the law in the investment treaties. That cannot be. It's an inversion of principles. We are also told in Europe that the problem can be solved by having an investment court. I would be against that. The investment court would simply mean that arbitrators who lack public authority would now have public authority in order to whitewash all the repressive laws that have been created in the past. They would be just washing machines that would churn out new rules that the same old rules, but with greater authority. You know, when you look at judges in England and judges in the United States, no less a person than the conservative judge, Judge Scalia, pointed out that almost all the judges of the Supreme Court of the United States come from the same background, they have been to the same law schools, have practiced commercial law, believe in the sanctity of property, sanctity of contracts, and these are the people who would sit on the European Court of Investments and churn out the same principles protecting investments to the detriment of the people. So the solutions that have been found out, have been proposed, are not good ones. We should go back to the old system where the courts, the domestic courts of every country, deals with disputes that arise. If they deal with them insufficiently, then of course there is an international method of diplomatic protection and state-to-state disputes to deal with the problem. Now I have exhausted my 5 minutes and I shall stop. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor. I wonder whether the definition of politically correct shows one of your pictures. Just a short quoting, because I don't want to skip time for Professor Armesto, which I assume that has a lot of things to say. You said that investment law is a body of legal principles to promote a standard of civilization that every country should aspire, that has been created by so-called scholars and arbitrators that create a superstructure over the existing treaties in favor of multinationals and acting in detriment of the population. This fiction is maintained without the consent of the states and provokes the reluctance of those states to move because of the fear to take regulatory actions in favor of the people. You have also evaluated the role of La Escuela de Salamanca, Suárez, Vitoria, Grotius. So let's say that we have a lot of things on the table. So I would like to give the floor to Professor Fernández Armesto.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I have a disclosure, a joke, and 6 points. The disclosure is I have a vested interest. I am one of these despised people who do investment arbitration. I earn my life with it, and so I have a vested interest. So I will be defending what I do. And of course, I am biased. For once, I'm biased. I don't think I am biased in my decisions, but I will be biased in defending the system. The second, we need a good joke. And there is a wonderful joke which I think explains very well what is happening with investment arbitration. This is a German. I'm almost German, so I can tell jokes about Germans. And it's the German who buys this beautiful chaise longue for his house. And then one day he comes home and finds his wife committing adultery in the chaise longue. And what is his reaction? He takes a chaise-longue and throws it out of the window. And that is what we are doing. I mean, the investment arbitration is the chaise-longue. We are being thrown out of the window because there is adultery. There is a certain problems which are different from the chaise-longue. 6 points. You will be surprised. I agree in the first point. I fully agree with Professor Sorna. I mean, completely. There is the inequality, and the inequality of the world is the most pressing problem we face. And every institution in international law must be geared towards this problem, the underdevelopment of certain countries and the inequality in the distribution of wealth. You only have to look how many people have died yesterday in the Mediterranean. 200? The day before, 3,000 this year? This is the sub-Saharan Africa in a situation of underdevelopment, a situation of gross inequality. So I really agree with that all we do must be viewed against this problem. The second point, and I think we start here disagreeing, is how to get out of the poverty trap. And I have no idea. If I would be born again, I would become a development economist. I think it is the most noble thing you can be in this world, is to contribute as an economist to development. But I make a very pragmatic analysis, and it is look at what has happened in the last quarter of a century. Which countries have risen out of the poverty trap? And you will see it is only those countries which have been able to export their way out of the poverty. India, look at India. While it was in autarky, there was no development. It was in the poverty trap, there was no way of getting out. How did it get out or start to improve the situation? By exporting, by opening to foreign investment. Look at China, look at Vietnam, look at Taiwan, look at Korea. If you look at them, you will see that there may be other factors, but one factor which is common to all countries which have escaped the poverty trap is foreign trade, foreign investment. Then the third problem. The problem is, and I will now tell you a case, one of my cases, which opened to me the eyes. It's one country in South America, a foreign investor in the electricity sector, and who built a huge power central, or a power plant.
A generating plant.
And after 1 year, after the investment, it's a very standard technology. It's just to create gas and convert that into electricity. After 1 year, there is a complete change in the legal system of the country, and what had looked to be a profitable investment becomes a total fiasco as an investment. And he starts an arbitration against the state. And this it's a well-known, worldwide, first-class investor from the United States. I can say that. And they show me the board minutes of their authorization to invest in that country. And it was based on a business plan which had a minimum return on investment, internal rate of return of 24%. And that opened to me the eyes. If you want, in Spain, to take a not very good country with a huge legal certainty, but in Spain, the equivalent number would be, what, 7, 8? So when you sell a kilowatt in, let's call it Andina, you must sell it a couple of times more expensive than in Spain. So if you live in a favela in Andina, of course you steal the electricity, because it's so expensive you cannot pay for it. And if you produce shirts in Andina, you cannot compete with the Chinese or Vietnamese who have not 24, have 8%. So the point about investment is, can you get investment without legal certainty, with arbitrary governments? Yes, of course. Yes, of course. It's not a question of quantity. It's a question of quality. How much you have to pay and what type of investors you attract. I mean, the mafia will invest in any country with 40% internal rate of return. You always can get funds. The thing, the lever of development is getting funds at 8, 9, 10%. And the whole regime, the only aim of the whole system is, by creating legal certainty, by limiting political arbitrariness, getting Andina from 24 to 12. And then the kilowatt in Andina will cost half as much. And Andina will be much more capable of competing. So that is my third problem. Then my fourth point is, do we need, and I think I heard the professor say, we do not need investment protection. There is no need. You have wonderful local courts. Go to the local courts. And let me just put an example. A close one. I have nothing to do with it professionally. Repsol in Argentina. Repsol makes the biggest foreign investment in their Spanish history. They purchase YPF, which is publicly owned. It's a billion euro investment. And the state decides, as states have the right to do. And I do not say states do not have the right, but the state says that it is in the interest of the Argentinian public to expropriate that investment. Is there any reason? Has there misbehaved? No. The reason is they have found a huge reserves of gas. And it is now in the interest of the state to expropriate it. This is fine. This is the states can do that. But there must be compensation. Now, if there had not been investment protection, do you really think that the court of Argentina would have given Repsol a fair hearing, a fair decision? And then the professor says, no, we have wonderful mechanism. Well, what other mechanism do we have in international law? Well, yes, we do have. Spain sent an armada to Peru. We sent a fleet to Callao, and we every time I am in Peru, they remind me of that. And we bombarded Callao because they had not paid the foreign debt. Spain held a huge amount of foreign debt of Peru. It had not been paid, and we sent, I don't know if it was effective, and we actually collected. But we did send an armada, and we did bomb the port of Callao. That is a gunboat policy. Well, that's a way of protecting investments.
It's no longer legal under international law.
But now they send arbitrators.
So the second thing is diplomatic protection. Of course, diplomatic protection, we killed diplomatic protection because we won, Spain won, the Barcelona traction case. And I will not get into the details, but it evidently became the end of diplomatic protection. It was such a disaster from the point of view of protection and efficiency and justice that I think it's the Spanish case which actually killed it. So there are not many other systems for protecting investments, and I do think that investors, foreign investors, have historically suffered legal uncertainty, political arbitrariness, and history teaches you that they often need further protection. My fifth point, the countries designed the system of investment arbitration. This is not a bottom-up system. Commercial arbitration was devised by society. Merchants created commercial arbitration. It evolved from the bottom, And then the states, the only thing they did is they gave an international treaty, the New York Convention. This is exactly the contrary from investment arbitration. It's a top-down system. States decided gunboats become illegal, as Professor House has shown. Diplomatic protection does not work. Someone, I think, at the World Bank, someone in the 60s decided, let's try something different. These merchants, they seem to be rather successful with arbitration. Let's try arbitration. And now the last point. You have arbitrators. So you take private individuals. You select them for a specific case. And what do arbitrators do? They apply the law. And they apply the law in the way this has been taught by international law, which when I come from commercial law, and when I first met international law, it's a funny way of applying the law. They are extremely literalist. I mean, international treaties are basically interpreted literally. So you do whatever the treaty says. Now, Professor says there are a number of things which are wrong. And I fully agree. I mean, it's up to the states to define the system. So they say you should never authorize circular investment, like the Yukos case. No, it's a Russian investor investing in Cyprus and then investing in Russia. Fine, of course. If that's what states want, there are a number of treaties, Swiss treaties, by the way, which have systems to avoid circular investments. You put that into the treaty, be sure arbitrators will apply it. You do not like FET. You don't like fair and equitable treatment. You think it's vague. I agree, it's vague. It's three words, free and equitable. We don't know what it means. Fine, exclude it. There are a number of treaties, all Chinese treaties, or many Russian treaties, which exclude it. They say only expropriation. What do tribunals do? They only apply it if there is expropriation. They never apply it to FET. You don't like it for protection for bonds. Okay, exclude bonds. If you put bonds into your list of investments, you cannot be surprised that arbitrators apply it to bonds. You don't like arbitrators to apply the treaty to legislative measures. Fine. But this is a problem of international law. Because international law, for good reasons, covers all aspects of the state's action. It covers not only administrative acts, it also covers judicial acts, denial of justice. It also covers legislative acts, and it is of all of the state and all its agencies and territorial bodies. And why does that? Because states, of course, have the power to legislate. And if you exclude the legislative powers, what all states will do is expropriate you without having an administrative act, just expropriate you by issuing some new law or regulation. International law noticed that long ago and created that universal responsibility. What have arbitrators done? They have applied international law. Now the international law professors say, no, we don't like international law. We would like to exclude the responsibility for legislative acts. Fine, do it. Say it in the treaty. We will not apply it. The thing, and this is now takes me back to my joke, and that is, this is the chaise longue. I mean, you are throwing out the chaise longue, saying the cause is the chaise longue. No. The cause is how you have defined the system. I finish saying, submitting to you that history shows us that foreign investors in certain countries, for justitia, require additional protection, Repsol. First point. And the second point is humanitas shows you that there is huge inequality in the world, that one of the basic causes of inequality is that in certain countries there is no legal certainty, seguridad jurídica, and that there is arbitrary political governments, and that if in international law wants to fight that, one of the instruments on offer is well-designed investment arbitration. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Armen. So the idea that has been shared on the table is very clear. States are sovereign. Arbitration, they can exclude fair and equitable treatment if they don't. They can exclude bonds if they want. But as long as that remains in the body of international law, arbitration has to apply it. And in fact, arbitration has mitigated, in many cases, very capricious actions of states disguised as regulatory actions. I would like to remark also that it is true that investment is not related to, maybe not related to development, but the quality of the investment can be very much related to the existence of legal certainty, and legal certainty exists to some extent when there is investment protection. So, with these two opposed views, Rob, you've had a very difficult task of reconciling them, if possible.
Thank you very much, Manuel and Dean Navarro, for the invitation to participate in this, I think, extremely timely debate on the future of the investment regime. I'll start in the manner of Professor Armesto and make two disclosures. One is that I have worked with Investors Council in a number of high-profile arbitrations, most of them New York Convention, some ICSID. The second disclosure, which has to do with Argentina, is that my partner is a native of Argentina. So perhaps if I say things that are less unkind to Argentina, I'm biased. I'm not sure. I'd like to begin with an overall observation. I come primarily from the world of international trade, law, and policy to the debate over investor protection. And one of the features of the globalization debate in the area of international trade is that there is a considerable divergence between the way in which experts, economists, see trade and the way that the critics of globalization see trade. And so even though, and I'm very much in their camp, economists like Joe Stiglitz, Danny Rodrick have questioned free trade absolutism, nevertheless, they still hold to the basic model that as long as you protect domestic regulatory diversity, removing barrier overt trade barriers like tariffs and quotas and so on is likely to increase both domestic and global welfare. And there can be exceptions, and so there are public policy exceptions in the various WTO agreements, which, however, don't exist, by the way, in most investment treaties. And that's one big difference between the trade and the investment regime. But still, the basic case for free trade, subject to exceptions and policy space and regulatory diversity, is pretty solid intellectually among economists and political economists. When we turn to the investment regime, it's an entirely different story. The narrative that the anti-globalization activists have concerning the investment regime is actually strongly supported by what economic experts and political economists and economic evidence have to say about it. So that's an interesting difference between the debate about globalization with respect to trade and the debate with respect to the investment regime. So that, as Professor Sanaraja said, There are dozens now of studies using rigorous social scientific techniques to try and examine whether the presence of a BIT or, you know, with investor-state dispute settlement actually leads to increases in investment flows. And, you know, the overall evidence is very negative, that, there's very little sign that they increase. And that, you know, there might be certain exceptions, such as a transitional economy using signing a bit as among the different signals that it is changing its economic policy. But generally speaking, there's very little incentivization of investment by signing BITs. Another interesting study is one that found that even with respect to political risk insurance, which is an alternative way of managing all these political risks we've been talking about, the existence of a BIT will not really affect either the premium that is being paid for political risk insurance or the likelihood of getting political risk insurance, which shows that the political risk insurance market also doesn't seem to particularly care about investor protection in terms of effectively managing or reducing political risk. So what about the story about a transitional economy that is trying to give a signal to global markets that they are, through a BIT, that they are actually moving to a more investor-friendly policy, which is the one case where, as I say, the empirical evidence suggests there might be some effect of a BIT in stimulating more investment. Well, in that case, we have to look at the downside, which is a transitional economy particularly will be experimenting with different regulatory approaches as it tries to decide how best to operate a market economy with government regulation. And while signing a BIT might increase some investment, it also imposes a significant cost on a government engaged in experimentalism in order to get its development policy correct. And Danny Rodrick and others have argued, and on the basis of a lot of empirical studies, that today this experimentalism is the best approach that developing countries can take, because there's no one formula. But if you can't experiment and if a privatization goes wrong, move back to an approach that, you know, is more of a public goods approach to electricity or water or whatever, without paying a huge fee in the form of damages to affected investors, the economic efficiency of experimentalism, which has been demonstrated by a vast amount of the new industrial policy literature, becomes problematic. So even in the one case where the economic evidence is you might get a bump in foreign direct investment, a transitional economy, you pay a high price by limiting your ability to engage in experimentalism to get the development model correct. So does foreign investment, however, explain the rapid growth and development of certain economies in Asia? And Professor Armesto referred to this. I've read dozens of economic papers about the Asian miracle because, in addition to doing trade policy, I've also spent the first part of my academic career writing a lot about industrial policy and co-authoring with political economists and economists and so on. The evidence is very clear, and it's summarized by Thomas Piketty in his wonderful book, Capital, which is, if you look at all these East Asian miracles, they were largely financed through internal capital markets and government spending, and not through foreign investment. If you want to have references to these papers, I'll show them to you. So the idea that it's basically foreign direct investment that led these economies to take off is one that's not sustained by the best evidence by the best economists. And we know that today. We know that the original Washington consensus thinking is not exactly right, that countries like Korea and so on used a combination of openness to export competition. They made their companies compete in world markets, but then they gave them a lot of active industrial policies to let them compete. Active industrial policies of sorts that might, in some cases, be challengeable under certain kinds of bilateral investment treaties or other trade agreements that have investor protections in them. So we know that. So the economic evidence doesn't sustain that. Can you use bilateral investment treaties to substitute for weak institutions in developing countries? Another issue that Professor Armesto has raised. The question is whether foreign investment is going to do a country a lot of good if it has weak institutions, weak rule of law, poor governance institutions. And again, when you actually go to the economic evidence that's available, the papers that are available, you will see that it's absolutely untrue that a country can shortcut strengthening its domestic institutions and get a lot of growth and development by promising foreign investors that they will be insulated from the rule of law problems in that country. And basically, that's another problem with BITs on the so-called rule of law rationale, substitute rule of law. Well, if you have substitute rule of law for foreign investors, the government, which might be a dictatorship or might not have a strong interest in strengthening domestic institutions for rule of law, can substitute needed domestic reforms in the direction of liberalism and democracy with foreign capital. And you can see that some of the biggest awards some very big awards in investor state dispute settlement are basically in resource cursed countries. Dictatorships, with lots of mines and so on, they don't mind BITs. Just pay the award and give the mine to your nephew, and then pay the award with money you've stolen from somebody else, And that's the way the game goes. So that's how much dignity in terms of justice investor state dispute settlement it has. I mean, it's really sustains the resource curse racket because, basically these countries can get away with, not reforming governance and still get foreign capital big time because they're willing to give the payout under the investment treaty. And often it's served their interests well in the past, less so today because we have a lot more transparency, because they could keep it kind of private what was really going on when they were stealing, from one to give to the other. So I don't think we get positive effects in terms of improving the rule of law and domestic institutions through in the investor protection regime. I think it takes off the pressure for positive domestic reform. And again, I can show you the social science, the political economy evidence that supports that. How many minutes do I have left?
Five more.
Okay, that's fine. So I want, this being said, it seems to me that there should be, and this is where I disagree with Professor Sanaraja, there should be some international forum that applies to investment disputes. Investment disputes engage in important international law values and concerns, and so to return to a kind of Westphalian world where investment disputes are considered to be a matter, quote unquote, of the internal affairs of each country seems to me to be rather atavistic. This being said, if you think about the argument in terms of international justice or international legal values, it makes no sense at all to have a direct right of action for investors to have recourse to an international tribunal where there's an investment dispute, and not for indigenous groups or environmental interests that are affected by the conduct of the investor, and so on. And the idea that Professor Sanaraja paraphrased that I'm not associating him with it at all. I don't think he would necessarily agree that corporations don't have requisite international responsibility or personality to be sued by other actors on the international plane. I think that's nonsense. We now have international criminal law, which gives responsibility for individuals. So I don't see. We have the Alien Tort Claims Act in the United States, where private actors can be sued for violations of the law of nations. So if we're going to have international norms applied to disputes about investment, we need to have international norms that reflect broader interests than the interests of investors. And we need to have a forum at the international level for resolving these disputes that's a forum that others can have access to justice to, not just investors. And I say that because I do think that investors are entitled to some access to justice at the international level. But what does international investment arbitration, as we know it today, have to do with justice? If you told me, I know about a justice system in Mars or wherever, and the basis of that justice system is that the people who are the judges in that system basically are judges because they are pursuing personal wealth, I would say I have a little issue with that. But that's exactly the way that investor arbitration works. These are judges for hire. The judges that we know in the US system, and I know that Professor Sonaraja is critical because most of them come from Harvard and Yale or wherever, nevertheless, you know, they're paid enough to have a decent middle class income, but nobody would go into judging in America in order to develop a personal fortune. But this is exactly what the top arbitrators have been doing. And so one proposal I have, you wouldn't even have to change any treaty, is that countries could get together, they could talk about it at UNCTAD, and they could each do it individually. I think that every arbitrator who is supposed to be a judge, someone seeking justice, not fortune, should have to disclose publicly all the wealth or income that they have received through activities related to investor-state arbitration. And then I think we would have a picture, right? And so one of the arguments of the arbitration bar that the court alternative will not work as proposed by the EU is, well, you know, how do you expect people to do this job of judging properly these complex cases unless they're paid by the hour and like $1,000 an hour? I think that's absolutely absurd. No US judge is paid that amount, not even Supreme Court justices, and they have stricter rules also about what they can do if they leave the bench in terms of private practice or representing parties after they leave. And in fact, the investor state system is so corroded that, you know, it's acceptable that somebody can be a judge in one case and they can be counsel in another case where a similar legal issue arises and where the interest of their client would be in the resolution of that legal issue one way or another. Now, why don't we have to worry about that too much? They say, well, there's no precedent in investor state arbitration, and so we don't have to worry about it. And this is my final remark, because I'm clearly running out of time very quickly. The lack of certainty that comes from the absence of precedent and appellate review in investor state arbitration, I think, is a big problem. I do not agree with Professor Sonaraja that there is a tendency to follow in a consistent way earlier awards. I mean, they're cited a lot because, you know, there's a lot of verbiage in these arbitration awards, and there should be a lot of verbiage when you realize the judges are paid by the hour in order to write them. You don't need to be a Nobel Prize-winning economist to understand the incentives at work when you pay judges by the hour a very high fee. But the lack of certainty really advantages investors and managers. And that's why I think that they are so opposed to moving to a court system which would have an appellate body and would have more certainty. And I just want to explain in 1 minute why the uncertainty benefits investors. It benefits them because in the presence of uncertainty, a firm and its managers lose very little by pursuing a claim, regardless of their estimate of the likelihood of its success. On the other hand, the government and government managers, if they don't settle, risk an enormous payout. Now, under conditions of uncertainty, that gives firms an asymmetric power to push a settlement. And that asymmetric power is being increased even further by third-party funding, because you get a third-party funder on board, like a sort of the equivalent of a vulture fund, and they have a portfolio of these claims. So they basically can hedge the uncertainty involved in any one decision by holding a diversified a portfolio, a little like, as I say, a vulture fund or maybe a venture capitalist. So given the risk of not settling for governments and government managers, and there being very little risk in an investor's taking their chances with a claim, at most they'll have to pay costs, but then the third-party funder comes in and mitigates that kind of risk, it's not surprising that many of the greatest injustices from this system are ones where the investor has been able to force a settlement of a claim that maybe, if it actually had been litigated by fair-minded judges, would have been thrown out of the tribunal.
Bueno, there is a lot to discuss, so in my, I would outline your intervention by acknowledging that there is no specific relation between development and investment, but not only that, but also that some positive effects of regulation are less efficient because of the existence of the system of investment protection. But in the end, you acknowledge that we need some way of solving disputes in international law. But that system must take into account that certainty is extremely important, which is something that Professor Armesto agrees and has deposited the responsibility to edge that predictability, that certainty, on the roof of states. And also you pointed out that the revenues of the arbitrators and the double hat debate are extremely relevant, because arbitrators are not to be, are not supposed to be independent if they are counseling in one case and arbitrating in a different case. So I know I can assume that the panelists have a lot a lot of things to say to each other, but that's not the idea of this seminar. I would ask the panelists to address the topics that have been touched while discussing with the audience. And I would like to open the floor for the audience. I mean, you would never say we have people from governments, we have Dutch people, we have people from the European Commission, we have a lot of practitioners. So please mention your name and your affiliation, and feel free to give your hard opinions as our panelists have done.